doing one of my favorite chapters tonight. One of my favoriteest chapters. 1 Kings chapter 18. 1 Kings chapter 18. This is, of course, I probably say this about a lot of chapters, don't I? It's hard to, sometimes people will say to me, what's your favorite chapter? What's your favorite verse in the Bible? I don't know if I can just have one. There's a lot of good stuff. But this definitely is in the top 10. I would hope it's in the top 10. After the death of King Solomon, the kingdom of Israel split into two parts. The northern kingdom became known as Israel. It would be made up of 10 of the 12 tribes of Israel. The first king of the north, his name was Jeroboam, and he led the people away from the true worship of Yahweh. He did this by setting up those golden calves. And we don't think that his intent was that they were worshiping somebody else. We're thinking that, it's my understanding, is that he thinks Yahweh looks like a cow. And that's the idea, is that this is who Yahweh is. But he leads them away from God in doing that, setting up this substitute. The southern kingdom was known as Judah, and it would be made up of the tribes of Judah and Benjamin. And the southern kingdom would always be tied, always be ruled by a descendant of David, by the Davidic dynasty. Last week, we followed the events in the northern kingdom as one dynasty is replaced by another. And we're now in the period ruled by the worst of the worst. His name is Ahab. His wife's name is Jezebel. Very good. He is the worst of the northern kings. And during this time of great wickedness, God has a voice. God works through somebody. The prophet Elijah is on duty during this worst of times. I kind of find that encouraging, that when things are the worst, there is somebody around. Just before the fall of the southern kingdom, there would be Jeremiah, Daniel, Ezekiel, prophesying, warning the people. God always has a witness, and here it's the prophet Elijah. Elijah's ministry begins with the warning that there would not be any rain until he says so. And the nation has now been in a drought for 3 years, along with the accompanying famine, because that's what a drought does. Everything dries up. There's no food. The crops are all dead. And so people start dying. This chapter is probably, you know, what he is famous for, what we're going to look at tonight. This is Elijah's greatest hits, is this chapter, probably. This is his shining moment. But last week, as we saw in chapter 17, before he gets to this moment, he went through the difficulty himself. He went through the drought. He went through the famine. He went through a time of refining and pruning before he gets to this place. So, chapter 18, verse 1. And it came to pass, after many days, that the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year, saying, go present yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain on the earth. So it takes 3 years. James tells us that it's actually 3.5 years, to be a little more specific. We find that out in James chapter 5, verse 17. Elijah is somebody that we expect to see again in the last days. He's going to show up. Malachi chapter 4, verse 5, which is written long after Elijah, says, behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. Elijah's going to come back. Now, whether it's exactly the same guy, which it could be, because he will be swooped up into heaven without apparently dying. So it's possible that he does come back, the real Elijah. On the other hand, just to give you a balanced presentation about this, John the Baptist was considered a type of Elijah. We're told that he came in the spirit and power of Elijah, but he wasn't Elijah. So it could be something like that, but I kind of tend to lean towards the actual guy showing up, Elijah. We think that he's one of the two witnesses in the book of Revelation. We saw this in chapter 11 a year or so ago when we did Revelation, where he says, And I will give, God says, I will give power to my two witnesses, and they will prophesy 1,260 days clothed in sackcloth. These are the two olive trees and the two lampstands standing before the God of the earth. And if anyone wants to harm them, fire proceeds from their mouth and devours their enemies. And if anyone wants to harm them, he must be killed in this manner, with the idea of the fire. These have the power to shut heaven so that no rain falls in the days of their prophecy. And they have power over waters to turn them to blood and to strike the earth with all plagues as often as they desire. Now, if you look at some of the things that these guys are going to do, they're going to call down fire from heaven, which we're going to see tonight is one of Elijah's specialties. They also have the ability of stopping the rain, which is what we've seen now between chapter 17 and 18, where it's been 3.5 years. Also, if you notice the length of these two witnesses, their ministry was 1,260 days, which is how many years? You want to hazard a guess? 3.5 years. So what it's kind of, you see the parallels here. Also in verse 1, it's the word of the Lord, God saying, I will send rain. In chapter 17, it says, Elijah the Tishbite of the inhabitants of Gilead said to Ahab, as the Lord God of Israel lives, before whom I stand, there shall not be dew nor rain these years except at my word. And we were a little bit unsure about at whose word, because it almost could sound like Elijah is saying it's at my word. I'm the guy with the hand on the spigot. And I turn on the water and I turn off the water. You can kind of read it that way. But here we find in our passage that it's actually God's word. God is the word of the Lord came and God says, I will send rain. And so it's God that's behind turning on and turning off the spigot. You see what I'm saying here in our passage in chapter 1, chapter 18, verse 1? God's the one, it's at his word. God's the one that says, I will send rain. Now, when prophecy comes, when God speaks through a person, it is kind of confusing sometimes. Is this God speaking or is this the person speaking? It is kind of hard. We aren't always sure, is this God speaking or is this you speaking? Some of Elijah's trouble that we're going to see him get into this chapter and the next, some of the trouble is because Ahab thinks that Elijah's the guy that's doing it all. That Elijah's the guy with the magic, you know, the magic rain stick, you know, and he's the guy that can make it rain and stuff. When in reality, it's not Elijah at all. Elijah's just the one speaking the message. It's God that's behind it. You follow me? So here, God is the one that's making the judgment. God is the one that's making the call on whether it's going to rain or not. So verse 2. So Elijah went to present himself to Ahab. That's the king. That's the bad guy, the bad king. And there was a severe famine in Samaria. Now, there's a famine in Samaria. Samaria is the capital city of the northern kingdom. That's where Ahab lives. We've already seen Elijah is from Tishbe, and he was living for a while near the brook Cherith. He then moved up to Zarephath, where he lived with the widow. And now he's going to show himself to Ahab somewhere around Samaria. That's kind of the path that Elijah is taking. So he goes to present himself to Ahab, and there was a severe famine in Samaria. That kind of gives you an idea of the territory that he's moving. These are, you know, like 15, 30 miles at a shot. And Ahab called. And Ahab had called, verse 3, Obadiah, who was in charge of his house. Now, Obadiah feared the Lord greatly, for so it was, while Jezebel massacred the prophets of the Lord, that Obadiah had taken 100 prophets and had hidden them 50 to a cave and had fed them with bread and water. Now, the story about Jezebel killing the prophets, we don't know, we've never heard that before. And we don't have the specific story of when that happened. It all kind of comes as if we already knew about this, but we don't. We just kind of hear about this as an aside here. But apparently she killed a bunch of Yahweh's prophets. she's the one that's behind the worship of Baal and Ashtoreth, and the Asherah, the Ashtoreth. And so she's trying to get rid of the opposition. But this fellow, Obadiah, had rescued some of the prophets. Obadiah feared the Lord. He's the right-hand guy of Ahab. He's the head guy in Ahab's government. He feared the Lord. His name means servant of Yahweh. Here's where you kind of get the idea that the guy's name does fit. Remember Ahab, or was it Ahab? No, Omri, the guy that didn't fit, because it's something like, you know, disciple of Yahweh or something. Remember from last week, it's like, not really. He really wasn't a follower of Yahweh. But Obadiah's name, this one fits, servant of Yahweh. In the world, but not of it. Obadiah, he's a God follower. And yet he is working for the wickedest guy in the world. I don't know what your politics are. Some people, you know, think that of our current president. And I'm not sure that I'm going to go there. But it would be like he was the chief of staff of the president. Something like that. I know people who would say, how dare he do that? How dare this good man work for somebody so bad like Ahab? Daniel, what do you think of Daniel the prophet? I mean, he was an awesome guy. Amazing guy, followed God. He worked for another incredibly wicked pagan man, Nebuchadnezzar. We are to be in the world, but not of the world. We are God's representatives in a wicked world. Sometimes we get the idea that we're supposed to all run off and join a monastery and live off in a hill somewhere and just, you know, only hang out with Christians. And I got news for you. That is not God's intent for us. Obadiah is God's intent for us, to be his light in a wicked world. Jesus said, "You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven." We don't need to be hiding from the world. We need to be impacting the world.
Here at the National Institute for Student Ministries, we developed a revolutionary method specifically designed to bring a fresh awareness to the Christmas season.
Merry Xmas, little girl! Merry Xmas! Oh, ho, ho!
It may appear unorthodox, but the results are staggering.
Merry Xmas!
Why do I want to be the Christmas linebacker? Well, let me put it to you this way. You see, I'm here to put the Christ into Christmas. Let me hear you say Jesus.
Jesus!
Now, don't mess with the linebacker, babies. Say it like you mean it. Say Jesus.
Jesus!
You see, when I hear Xmas, there's something that bubbles inside of me. X is only relevant to a few things. X-Files, X-Football players, but not Xmas. It's Christmas.
Merry Xmas, Merry Xmas.
This ain't no sleigh ride, baby.
We're intrigued by the linebacker's emotional, spiritual, and psychological influence. Not to mention the physical impact. Yes, Christmas is all about sharing the love.
Who wants eggnog?
His theology? Well, it's impacting.
You see, God didn't show up in a rocket ship. He didn't show up in a Cadillac. He showed up as a baby. That's what Christmas is about. You dig? See, you've heard about the shepherds being meek, but the linebacker's here to give you a tweak!
Yes, we certainly do know how to tackle Christmas.
You see, materialism has ruined Christmas. It's not about presents under a tree. It's about God's presence with us.
Not sure what you need this Christmas?
Merry Xmas, son. Open and hurry.
I wanted a basketball! Not a football, a basketball, right now!
We've got the perfect gift for absolutely everyone.
So why are you smiling? You just disrespected your parents. What's wrong with a football?
From all of us here at NIFSM, we hope your Christmas is a real hit.
Well, we're supposed to impact the world, but maybe not quite like that. Sorry, I couldn't resist. Verse 5. But I like Obadiah. I like the fact that God has a man right in the center of Ahab's court. Verse 5. I don't know if he was the linebacker, though. Verse 5. And Ahab had said to Obadiah, go into the land to all the springs of water and to all the brooks. Perhaps we may find grass to keep the horses and mules alive so that we will not have to kill any livestock. Because remember, this is a famine. Everything's drying up. There's no food anywhere. So they divided the land between them to explore it, and Ahab went one way by himself, and Obadiah went another way by himself. So they're looking for food for their livestock. Verse 7. Now as Obadiah was on his way, suddenly Elijah met him, and he recognized him, and fell on his face and said, is it you, my lord Elijah? And he answered him, it is I. Go tell your master, Elijah is here. So he said, how have I sinned that you are delivering your servant into the hand of Ahab to kill me? As the Lord your God lives, there is no nation or kingdom where my master has not sent someone to hunt for you. And when they said, he is not here, he took an oath from the kingdom or nation that they could not find you. Elijah's the top 10 of, he's at the top of Ahab's most wanted list. And now you say, go tell your master Elijah is here, and it shall come to pass as soon as I am gone from you that the Spirit of the Lord will carry you to a place I do not know. So when I go and tell Ahab and he cannot find you, he will kill me. But I, your servant, have feared the Lord from my youth. So Obadiah has this idea that God's going to play some kind of a cosmic joke on him, and that he's going to go to Ahab and said, I found Elijah, and he wants to talk to you, and he's going to bring him, and Ahab will show up, and Elijah will be gone. He just knows this is going to be a trick, and he's going to end up in trouble. Verse 13, was it not reported to my Lord what I did when Jezebel killed the prophets of the Lord, how I had hid 100 men from the Lord's prophets, 50 to a cave, and fed them with bread and water? Now, you know, he's thinking that this is just nothing but trouble for him. He's going to be the one getting in trouble. And he says, didn't you know that I'm a good guy here? Why are you trying to get me into trouble? Now, when we get to chapter 19, I just got to lay the foundation. It's going to be a couple of weeks because we're not going to get there in the next couple of weeks because of all the holiday stuff. But when we get to chapter 19, Elijah's going to be playing the pity party card. And he's going to be saying, I'm the only guy left serving God. But keep in mind what Obadiah is saying. He's got 100 guys tucked away in a cave. So when we get to chapter 19, keep in mind at least what Obadiah is saying, that there's 100 guys out there that I've been holding on to and protecting. So, but he says, don't you know that I'm one of the good guys? And now you say, go tell your master Elijah is here. He will kill me. Then Elijah said, as the Lord of hosts lives, as Yahweh of hosts lives, before whom I stand, I will surely present myself to him today. And so, Obadiah is just convinced that this is bad news. He's just convinced of this. He's the ultimate pessimist. And when times are hard, gang, we can fall into the trap of thinking that everything in life is bad and God is out to get me. It's not hard to fall into that trap, is it? Where you start thinking that everything's bad. And even if somebody says something that most people would say is a good thing, we kind of take it for bad. There's a story of identical twins. One was a hope-filled optimist. Everything's coming up roses, he would say. The other one was a sad and hopeless pessimist. He thought that Murphy, as in Murphy's Law, that he was an optimist. The worried parents of the boys brought them to a local psychologist. He suggested that to the parents a plan to balance the twins' personalities. At Christmas, put them in separate rooms to open their gifts. Give the pessimist the best toys you can afford and give the optimist a box of manure. The parents followed these instructions and carefully observed the results. When they peeked in on the pessimist, they heard him audibly complaining, "I don't like the color of this computer. I'll bet the bike's going to break. I don't like this game. I know someone who's got a bigger toy car than this." They go across the hallway to the optimist, and they peek in to watch their optimist gleefully throwing manure up in the air. He's giggling. "You can't fool me. Where there's this much manure, there's got to be a pony." I like that story. Proverbs 15:15 says this: "All the days of the afflicted are evil, but he who is of a merry heart has a continual feast." I think that there's a sense that there's a choice that we make in life. Am I going to be the afflicted, or am I going to be the merry of heart? Some of us feel that we're victims, and we feel there's no choice in this. I am afflicted. This is what life has given me. And other people, you know, they just happen to have lucked out to get all their cool stuff, and that's why they're so happy. You know what? There's a part of that is a choice of ours. All the days of the afflicted are evil. No matter what happens, you've got a reason to think that something bad is around the corner. Some of that's a choice. Some of that is a choice. But he who is of a merry heart has a continual feast. There's got to be a pony in here somewhere. I believe this, gang. I really do. I've held on to that verse for a long time, and I see it. We make some choices on how we're going to handle issues. It's not easy to change it, but it can change. Some of how I'm looking at my life, some of it is my choice. Verse 16. "So Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him, and Ahab went to meet Elijah." So Obadiah went to meet Ahab. Obadiah has been through tough times. There's been the drought. He's tried to stay faithful to the Lord. And for some reason, he looks at Elijah, who he calls his Lord, you know, his boss, but he doesn't think he can trust him. He sees Elijah as someone who causes trouble and heartache for people. And he's adopted some of Ahab's views on Elijah. Need to be careful about being afraid of God's will. Sometimes we can fall into the trap of being afraid of what God's going to do to me. When Elijah was living with the widow, she said to Elijah, because her son dies, she said, "What do I have to do with you, O man of God? Have you come to me to bring my sin to remembrance and to kill my son?" She's thinking that the death of her son had to do with Elijah's presence, and that somehow God was looking through Elijah and realizing what a terrible person she was, and that's why her son died. Had nothing to do with that. In fact, God was going to raise her son from the dead. Paul's understanding of God's will for our lives, he says this, "I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God." I remember growing up as a kid. I grew up going to church. Grew up in the Grand Methodist Church. And I had this notion that if I got serious about God, that my life would be ruined. You know, that probably I'd end up as a missionary in Africa or something like this. You know, I remember even when we switched to the Baptist church, I was a little bit reluctant about getting too serious about God, because he's going to make me do something horrible. He's going to make me eat the box of manure that went to that one kid. You know, that's probably what he has in mind for me. He's going to ruin my life. I don't know if you've ever gone down that road before. But my friends, that is not how God's will works. When you give yourself to him and you let him do what he wants in your life, he proves what his will is for us, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. God's will is good. It tastes good. I mean, it'd be like somebody forcing me to go to Polly's and eat their pie. Oh, what a terrible thing. I don't want to eat Polly's pies. No, not Polly's pies. Are you kidding me? What are you dragging your feet for? God's will is like that, beloved. You know, poor Obadiah, he swallowed some of the thinking of the world that he needs to be afraid of God's will. No, 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 my beloved. No. There's nothing better for your life than God's will. Yield it to him. Let him do all that he wants in your life. Because his will is good. It's acceptable. And it's perfect. It's perfect. Don't need to be afraid of it. Not at all. Not at all. God didn't make me a missionary to Africa. Though actually nowadays, that probably doesn't sound so bad to me anymore. I mean, it sounds like Daniel and Laura are having a blast in Africa. You know, I used to be terrified at the idea of missions. Oh my gosh. Now that I've been on a few trips, it's like, wow, what's so hard about it? It is not. It is not what you build up in your mind, God's will. Verse 17. So Ahab goes to meet Elijah. Then it happened when Ahab saw Elijah that Ahab said to him, "Is that you, O troubler of Israel?" And he answered, "I have not troubled Israel, but you and your father's house have, in that you have forsaken the commandments of Yahweh and have followed the Baals." O troubler of Israel, whose fault is it? 3.5 years without rain. And Ahab has settled into the mindset that it's Elijah's fault. Because he did say, "There ain't going to be any rain unless it's at my word." He's the guy that said that, you know. It's Elijah's fault. He's the one that's caused us so much trouble. Now, I'm going to show you a movie clip. It's going to make some of you offended. I'll just tell you that right off the bat. Some of you might be offended. It's from a 1997 movie that I watched with my kids called Rocket Man. And it's a comedy. It's about a future mission to Mars. And the hero of the movie is kind of a bit like Jerry Lewis, kind of that kind of a character. And all through the movie, he does these stupid things, and he keeps saying one line over and over, "It wasn't me. It wasn't me."
We got a red on Overbeck.
We have a primary oxygen
tank. Okay, we need to preserve his SOP. I give you permission.
Emergency tie line. We'll commit to another suit.
Do it, Doc.
Bill, this is Houston. You got a leak in your primary O2 tank.
I see it, Houston. What do we do?
You've got an emergency line in your Pliss. Hook it up with Randall's spare vent nozzle, and you'll share it till you get back to the Pilgrim.
Houston, is that sanitary?
Hey, Commander?
Yeah?
I seem to be experiencing these intense intestinal cramps.
Randall, I'm trying to conserve oxygen here.
But they hurt me, so...
Keep it to yourself.
Ow. Ow. Ow.
Wait
a minute. Ow. Ow.
I think if we stay on this heading for another 20 minutes, we'll see the Pilgrim.
What? I didn't do anything.
Oh, my God. No, 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 no. Hey, 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 hey. Don't do that. No, no. Oh, man! Oh! Whoa. Oh!
It was me.
What do you mean it wasn't you?
We're 35 million miles from the nearest person!
Heart rate up, adrenaline up, stomach muscle spasming. Overbeck's in distress.
Look at these methane levels.
Methane? Oh, it's in my mouth.
Hey, he who smelt the Delta.
Oh.
What?
You're having trouble breathing. My eyes are burning.
Truly, it wasn't me. Maybe it was Julie.
Dog.
Hey, miracles can happen.
Blaming this on Julie.
Okay, I admit it was me.
Thank you.
Now that was Julie.
It wasn't me. In Elijah's day, the reason for the drought was because of God's judgment on the sin of Israel. And it was Ahab that led them into it. And what does he do? He puts it off on Elijah. Wasn't me, Ahab would say. It wasn't me. My friends, we're getting better and better today at pointing our fingers at other people instead of accepting responsibility for our own behavior. I'm trying to learn to recognize this. You know, I've got friends who've got struggles with certain addictions and stuff, and I see it. You see that you hear the excuses, and for years I've swallowed all the excuses. Oh, poor you. All this kind of stuff. You know what? The difficult things didn't put a gun to your head. You made bad choices. Watch what Ahab's doing. It's your fault, Elijah, that we're in this mess. Oh, no. Oh, no. Elijah says, it's your fault, buddy. You're the one that caused all this to happen. Years ago, I had a guy telling me that he hit his wife, and then he told me it was her fault, that she drove him to it, and he was unwilling to admit that it was his fault. Oh, well, she nags me, and she drives me crazy. you know what? You're an idiot. You're the one with the hand. You're the one that's doing this. The Bible says, he who covers his sins will not prosper, but whoever confesses and forsakes them will have mercy. Now, while I'm talking about this, we can all think about other people who make excuses. The hard thing is to face our own sins and to realize that I can't blame other people for my stuff. I have to own up to me being responsible. This is Ahab's problem. He wants to blame somebody else when it's his fault. Verse 19. Now therefore, send and gather. This is Elijah speaking. Now therefore, send and gather all Israel to me on Mount Carmel, the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table. Gather all Israel. There's going to be a showdown, kind of just like the classic Westerns. The showdown's going to be between Elijah and the prophets of Baal and Asherah. One man against 850. Classic showdown.
Get three coffins ready.
Just like this.
Listen, stranger, did you get the idea? We don't like to see bad boys like you in town. Go get your mule. You let him get away from you?
You see, that's what I want to talk to you about. He's feeling real bad.
Huh?
My mule. You see, he got all riled up when you went and fired those shots at his feet.
Hey, you making some kind of joke?
No. You see, I understand you men were just playing around, but the mule, he just doesn't get it. Of course, if you were to all apologize. I don't think it's nice you laughing. You see, my mule don't like people laughing. It's the crazy idea you're laughing at him. Now, if you apologize, like I know you're going to, I might convince him that you really didn't mean it.
I saw the whole thing. You killed all four of them. You'll pay all right. You'll be strung up.
Who are you?
Don't fire a shot. I'm John Baxter. Sheriff.
Yeah. Well, if you're the sheriff, you better get these men on the ground. My mistake, four coffins.
Fistful of dollars. It was hilarious because I'm watching this about five, six times today. It's got all the elements of Elijah. Not a mule, but God. You better apologize. There is a sheriff. It's not a sheriff. It's Jezebel who's going to be blaming Elijah. It's hilarious and interesting. Oh, well, sorry. Verse 20, showdown. Here we go, verse 20. So Ahab sent for all the children of Israel and gathered the prophets together at Mount Carmel. Carmel means the vineyard of God. Carmel is actually the Hebrew. Mount Carmel is on the coast, overlooks up to the north. It overlooks the port city of Haifa. It's actually a range of hills that overlook the Jezreel Valley, which is the most fertile, productive valley in Israel. Here, this is the Jezreel Valley up here. There's a stream that we're going to see, the stream Kishon, which is like a creek that runs along the bottom. Carmel is one of the places you visit on Israel. This is back in 2007. There's a monastery at the tip of it, and it overlooks on one side of the monastery. When you climb up to the top, there's a viewing platform. And off to the left here is the Jezreel Valley. To the right, I don't have a view of it, but off to the right is where the Mediterranean is. Here's a statue of Elijah to remind you what took place. And this gives you an idea of some of the view. This is looking southward along the coast. This is the pass along here that runs by the city of Megiddo. We happened to hit it on a stormy day, perfect for the story of Elijah. Not our point in the story, but later on. And you pan to the left, this is that valley that runs along Megiddo.
See the three towers over to the left? Then there's a little tower, and you see how it's darker gray?
Yeah, that's
Megiddo would be right in around here.
No, it's not. Right, right. Sometimes it evaporates
right in around, in this area is Megiddo.
Sometimes
and as we pan across the left, this is the Jezreel Valley.
I do not agree with you.
Okay, well, you don't have to agree.
I that's see no glass.
I think you are doing
something. I don't see.
No, I want my money back.
So I'm the one that paid.
Carmel. This is a little bit of the view that you'd see up on the top of Carmel. Elijah, verse 21, came to all the people and said, so the whole people are all gathered up on the top, and he says to all the people, how long will you falter between two opinions? If the Lord, if Yahweh is God, follow him. But if Baal, follow him. And the people answered him, not a word. How long will you falter between two opinions, he says. You know, Greg Glory will say this, undecided is not an option. The button on the elevator, it goes up and it goes down. There's no undecided when you get to an elevator. You're either for God or you're against God. There's no place for being unsure. To be undecided is to be decided. Joshua said, choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And so Elijah's giving them the same choice. You need to choose who you're going to serve. Then Elijah said to the people, verse 22, I alone am left a prophet of the Lord, but Baal's prophets are 450. He says, I alone am left. True or false? False. There you go. It's not true. Obadiah has already said he has 100 guys stashed in the cave somewhere. This is kind of funny. You know, here's the awesome prophet of God, and he's wrong about something. So, but he says, I alone am left, but Baal's prophets are 450. Therefore, verse 23, let them give us two bulls, and let them choose one bull for themselves, cut it in pieces, lay it on the wood, but put no fire under it. And I will prepare the other bull and lay it on the wood, but put no fire under it. So each group's going to prepare a sacrifice. They're just not going to light the fire. Verse 24, then you call on the name of your gods, and I will call on the name of Yahweh. And the God who answers by fire, he is God. So all the people answered and said, it is well spoken. We like this idea. This is a great showdown. We'll have, you know, the two gun guys at each end and we'll shoot it out. We'll see who wins. The God who answers by fire. Elijah is challenging the Baal worships, the Baal worshipers at the very core of their belief system. I don't know if you remember this from last week, but Baal is the storm god. He's the guy who invented lightning bolts. He should have an easy, this should be an easy thing for Baal. And they're already up at the top of a mountain. I mean, that's where lightning's going to strike, you know. This is easy. This should be easy. What better test than this? But don't forget, gang, the miracles don't start at Carmel. Don't make the mistake of thinking that Elijah's amazing life starts in chapter 18. It didn't. We saw last week, we saw a little bit of the 3 years run-up to chapter 18. It starts in chapter 17. How can Elijah have the guts to do something like this? I mean, think about this. My God versus your God. And we'll set up this test and see which God answers by fire. I mean, would you do that? I wouldn't do that. Oh my gosh, I wouldn't do this. But think of what Elijah has lived through. Living at Kerith for a few years. That's the brook Kerith. And I don't know if you remember this, but Kerith, the word means cutting. And then moving to Zarephath, which means literally refining. And we talked about the process in Elijah's own life of God pruning, cutting things back in his life. Of the refining that would go on, like at Zarephath. The idea of learning to live by trusting the ravens to deliver food every day. Morning and evening, they delivered food. Ravens don't do that. They're not carrier pigeons. They're selfish birds. They sometimes let their own babies starve, let alone they're not going to feed him. He's learned that God provides. He's learned that he can trust God to take care of him. He's lived it for 3 years. And so when God says, we're going to do something special, he trusts him. He trusts God. This isn't Elijah's manufacture. He's not the one coming up with this test. This is something that God has brought him to do. Too often we want to put ourselves in the place of pulling off a Mount Carmel without having lived through Kerith and Zarephath. Does that make sense? See, it's a life that's learned to be trained and disciplined by following God, letting God provide, letting God show me what he can do. You got to take baby steps first. You got to learn to follow him, even in the hard times, through the famine. That's what gets him to Carmel. The people like this idea. They say it is well spoken. The people like the idea of a test. And my friends, people today are no different. They want to see what's real. They want to see God at work. They do. They're looking for men and women who have learned the real thing, to learn to really trust God day by day. Verse 25. Now Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, choose one bull for yourselves, prepare it first, for you are many, call on the name of your God, but put no fire under it. Now, this is just to make sure, just in case somebody would accuse Elijah of bringing the trick, snap your finger, bull turns into flame trick. They get to pick the bull. Okay, I'll let you pick your bull. You can even go first, okay? He's given them every advantage. So they took the bull, which was given to them, and they prepared it and called on the name of Baal from morning even till noon, saying, oh, Baal, hear us. But there was no voice. No one answered. The lights are on and no one is home. Then they leaped about the altar which they had made. So it was at noon. He gives them a good 3-4 hours here, maybe 6 hours. It was when it was at noon, Elijah mocked them. He's not the nicest of guys. He's got a wicked sense of humor. And he mocked them and he said, cry aloud, little louder, please, for he is a god. Either he is meditating or he is busy, or he's on a journey, or perhaps he is sleeping and must be awakened. Now, they're doing all their religious stuff for hours, and he decides to have a little fun with them. One of the words is kind of interesting. The word for he is busy, si'ig, moving away or dross. Literally, the idea is maybe he's in the potty. You know, he's indisposed at the moment. You know, he's in the WC, you know, the water closet or something, you know. I mean, he is having he's having fun with them. So they cried aloud and cut themselves, as was their custom, with knives and lances until the blood gushed out on them. This is apparently some of the ritual stuff when you really get serious with Baal. Then you start, you know, cutting yourself and bleeding, and then Baal knows you're really serious. And actually, everybody else is impressed, but since there really is no Baal at home, you know, he's not exactly impressed because he's nothing real. And when the midday was past, they prophesied until the time of the offering of evening sacrifice. But there was no voice, no one answered, no one paid attention. The time of the Jewish evening sacrifice is 3 p.m. So these guys are going at it at least from like 9 in the morning, maybe 6 in the morning, all the way to 3 o'clock. They are at this. They're doing their best, putting on their best show, and there's nothing. Verse 30. Then Elijah said to all the people, "Come near me, come near to me." So all the people came near to him, and he repaired the altar of the Lord that was broken down. Now, I don't know if this means there was already an altar there, or if this is figuratively that he's going to restore the worship of Yahweh. It could be either. Elijah took 12 stones according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Israel, to whom the word of the Lord had come, saying, "Israel shall be your name." He takes 12 stones. When Jeroboam divided the kingdom, he wanted the people to forget about the two tribes in the south. As far as the northern kingdom is concerned, there's only 10. There's only 10 tribes. But Elijah makes an altar with 12 stones because he wants to remind everybody there are 12 tribes, not 10. There's 12 tribes. The church is a little bigger than some people would lead you to believe. Some people like to think that only their little group is the only ones that are going to make it in heaven. The story goes that a guy dies and he goes to heaven, and while Peter's showing the guy around heaven, they come to an area that's surrounded by a wall. And the person says, what's this wall doing here? And Peter says, well, behind that wall are all the Calvary Chapel people, and they think they're the only ones up here. So we want to be quiet. We don't want to disturb them, you know. Now, I know that we don't really believe that, but there are groups that will say that. And I don't want you to misunderstand me. I am not saying that all roads lead to heaven. The Bible does not teach that you can get to heaven through Buddha or through Muhammad. The Bible makes it clear that the way to heaven was through Jesus. But there are a lot of churches that teach the truth about this. You know, you can be going to a Methodist church, a Catholic church, a Baptist church, Evangelical Free Church, Calvary Chapel, a lot of churches that teach the truth about Jesus. And sometimes we like to think that it's only our little thing. I love this principle here. Elijah makes an altar of 12 stones. Let's have a little reality check, folks. Israel is 12 tribes, not 10. Us in the north might think it's only 10. It's 12. Verse 32, then with the stones, he built an altar in the name of the Lord. And he made a trench around the altar large enough to hold 2 seahs of seed. That's about 13 quarts. That's how much of the trench is. And he put the wood in order. He cut the bull in pieces, laid it on the wood, and said, fill 4 water pots with water and pour it on the burnt sacrifice and on the wood. Now, if this is similar to the water pots in John chapter 2, those water pots were about 20 gallons each. That makes 4 water pots about 80 gallons. And so he says, fill 4 water pots, pour it on the burnt sacrifice. And And then he said, do it a second time. And they did it a second time. He said, do it a third time. And they did it a third time. So he's getting a little dramatic here. You know, he's just a little bit of effect, kind of rubbing it in. He has like 240 gallons of water he's pouring in. The water's running everywhere. He just wants to make sure that nobody thinks that, you know, we've got, you know, we're not pouring gasoline on this thing. We're pouring water on this thing. It's very clear that if anything happens, it's going to be God. So the water ran all around the altar, and he also filled the trench with water. And it came to pass at the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice that Elijah the prophet came near and said, now, we're going to read his prayer, but look how long his prayer is. Okay? I don't know if you want to count the words. You can count the words, but this is his prayer. Lord God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known this day that you are God in Israel, and I am your servant, that I have done all these things at your word. Hear me, O Lord, hear me, that this people may know that you are the Lord God and that you have turned their hearts back to you again. The other guys have been praying and leaping and cutting and stuff for at least 6 hours. Elijah's prayer hardly lasts 30 seconds. Just a quick note, short prayers are okay. God's not impressed with the length of our prayers. Jesus said, when you pray, don't use vain repetitions. Think it's not, God doesn't hear you because of the length of your prayers. Short prayers are okay. What God's looking for is your heart, not the length of your prayers. Sometimes we pray long prayers more to impress the people that are listening to us. God doesn't care about the length of your prayer. Certainly doesn't matter here. Elijah's got one of the shortest prayers in the Bible. He just says, like, you're God, I'm your man, show him. That's kind of like what he's saying, you know. Verse 38, then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering, the burnt sacrifice, and the wood, and the stones, and the dust, and it licked up the water that was in the trench. It's probably lightning when we're talking about the fire of the Lord fell. And keep in mind, this is not a stormy day like my day up on top of Mount Carmel. In a minute, you're going to see that they go looking for clouds, and there's no clouds in sight. So this is one of those days, one of those clear blue sky days. So fire comes out of nowhere. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces, and they said, Yahweh, he is God. Yahweh, he is God. The people turn to worship God. Part of me looks at what Elijah does, and I'm tempted sometimes to think I got to pull off the same kind of a thing. But the truth is not about me calling down fire from heaven. The truth is my life. The issue is my life. My life is the test. People want to see that God is real. And the way they're going to see that is in my life. He's got chutzpah, doesn't he? To pull this thing off, to stand up and say this. Our lives should be impacted by God in such a way that we can say to people, you know what? Maybe you don't believe in God, but you just watch my life. You watch and see if God is real. That's the challenge. That's the test. Jesus said, let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. That's what this is all about. It's your life. You don't have to be calling down fire, but God wants you to live for him. Let your life be the example. And Elijah said to them, seize the prophets of Baal. Do not let one of them escape. So they seized them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon and executed them there. He kills all the prophets. Kishon is that brook. I'll skip the map. It's that brook that runs alongside the mountain. And he executes them. Sounds a little bit harsh, but he's doing what God commanded Israel to do with false prophets. Verse 41, then Elijah said to Ahab, go up, eat and drink, for there is the sound of abundance of rain. And keep in mind, there are no rain clouds in sight. We'll see that in a minute. There are no rain clouds. But he tells Ahab, he makes a statement of faith. He says, you better get moving, buddy, because I hear the rain is coming. It's fascinating. Clear blue skies. I hear the rain's coming. There's been no rain for 3.5 years. So Ahab went up to eat and drink, and Elijah went up to the top of Carmel. Then he bowed down, because they've been down at the bottom by the brook. He goes back to the top. He bows down to the ground and puts his face between his knees and said to his servant, "Go up now, look toward the sea." So he went up and looked and said, "There is nothing." And seven times he said, "Go again." What's he doing? Bowing down to the ground, what's he doing? He's praying. He's asking God for rain. And each time he prays, he tells his servant, "Is there any rain yet? Do you see a cloud? Do you see a cloud?" Seven times, no clouds. Confess your sins, your trespasses to one another. Pray for one another that you may be healed. The effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. Elijah was a man with a nature like ours, and he prayed earnestly that it would not rain, and it did not rain on the land for 3 years and 6 months. He prayed again, and the heaven gave rain, and the earth produced its fruit. Sometimes God answers short prayers, like the fire, right? "You're God, I'm your man, go for it." Boom, fire. This time, it doesn't work that way, does it? He doesn't pray a simple prayer and rain appears. This time, he prays seven times before a little cloud shows up. Sometimes, God works through lots of prayer. Can't put God in a box. Can't say, "Oh, just five words ought to be enough." Well, sometimes you got to keep at it. Sometimes you got to keep at it. Verse 44, "And it came to pass the seventh time that he said," that the servant says, "There is a cloud as small as a man's hand rising out of the sea." So he said, "Go up, say to Ahab, prepare your chariot and go down before the rain stops you." Now it happened in the meantime that the sky became black with clouds and wind, and there was a heavy rain. So Ahab rode away and went to Jezreel. It's about 30 miles away, if they were at the far end of the mountain range. It was a heavy rain. Sometimes God answers prayer with fire. Sometimes God answers with rain. Interesting. "And the hand of the Lord came upon Elijah. He girded up his loins and ran ahead of Ahab to the entrance of Jezreel." I think that's fascinating. It could be somewhere between 10 and 30 miles, and he outruns a chariot. Crazy guy. We're done. I'm 5 minutes late. I am sorry. I apologize. No, maybe 3 minutes late. Let's stand and pray.